Whether you are in Lubbock or in Abilene or at a home here in Wichita Falls, Texas, we thank you today for listening to the program. This is about the culture of America. It is not simply about politics. We're looking at many things that are happening today. There's a lot occurring right here on the in the news scene all across our country. We want to talk about the so-called Russia collusion of President Trump. I want to talk about democratic socialism. And I do want to talk about the new suggestion by former President Obama paying people to not work. All of that coming up right now. So let's first of all begin with thinking about Russia and President Trump's meeting at Helsinki with Vladimir Putin. At one time, you realize that Russia could do no wrong. It doesn't matter what kind of dictator they had in place. It matters not what kind of bloodthirsty thug was running that country. The left has always loved communism. So even Joseph Stalin had his defenders here in America. The leftist folk singer Woody Guthrie, as Steve Bias in an article recently pointed out, even wrote a column defending Stalin's unprovoked invasion of Poland in 1939. However, today, Vladimir Putin, who of course is not a George Washington, but he's also no Stalin either, is the subject of more hatred, more vitriol from the left than anything I have ever seen. And the left is absolutely coming unraveled against President Donald Trump for meeting in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin. One of those who have come so unraveled is the former CIA director under Barack Obama, John Brennan. Brennan tweeted this: Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous, he continued. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? End of quote. And he even called for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and the Chief of Staff John Kelly to resign in protest. Brennan said, I'm at a loss of words to describe just how outrageous are these things and how his behavior has been and how Mr. Putin now is the master puppeteer of Donald Trump, the person who is in our Oval Office. Outrageous. End of quote. Now, that is just an example of some of the quotes or some of the reactions of the left. But what is so outrageous is the left itself. Men such as Brennan himself, who would even dare question someone's patriotism. In 1976, Brennan voted for Gus Hall, the candidate for the United States Communist Party, which at that time was wholly owned by the Soviet Union. That was in the middle of the Cold War when hundreds of Soviet nuclear missiles were pointed right at the United States, and during a time when the Soviet Union had thousands of political prisoners in its gulags, and yet Brennan voted for Gus Hall. He has no room to talk. These people, they are so left. They are so far on the left that they are communists themselves, and we're coming to a real friction point here in the United States. Looking back over the history of politics over the last century, for example, you might just note that it has always been the Democrat Party who has defended, who has supported the communists and the dictators all across the globe. It doesn't matter if you reach back to the 1920s or the 1930s, all the way up through the 1940s and 50s, in the Alger Hiss period, the Democrats have always favored these communists. Alger Hiss was sentenced to 5 years in prison in 1950, and Secretary of State Dean Acheson continued to support him, saying, I don't intend to turn my back on Alger Hiss. Where were the Democrats then who were crying for his blood? Because here was Alger Hiss, a confessed and convicted spy for the Soviet Union, and a part of the Roosevelt administration, but you don't hear anything about that. You can go to history classes in high school, history classes in colleges, and you don't hear a word about that kind of thing. Hiss played a critical role, for example, in the wartime Yalta Conference in 1945, when much of Eastern Europe was delivered to Stalin. And that was, of course, set up by and engineered by FDR. The conference played a huge role in the eventual fall of China to communism as well. But nobody on the left, no one in the press, the major news media, no, mainstream media, no one had anything to say about that. And Hiss was not the only spy in the United States government. As a matter of fact, there were several of them that had been pointed out to FDR while he was in office, but he just poo-pooed the whole concept and he wouldn't have anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, the exact number of spies, that is communist spies, in the government at that period of time is unknown, but it is clearly immense. According to Arthur Herman in his book, Joseph McCarthy, when two researchers reviewed KGB files and compiled a list of classified materials taken by Soviet spies such as Hiss, it ran to over 150 single-spaced pages. That's probably only a fraction of what they could have come up with and what the total was. Now, all of that simply points to the fact that the Soviets or communism, the Democrats have not met a communist they haven't liked. And for them to get after Donald Trump for meeting with Vladimir Putin in a meeting is absolutely ludicrous. It's unhinged in the extreme. When Ronald Reagan was president, there was no question that the most Democrat of all of them, the Democrats' leading politicians, favored communist dictators over the American president. George McGovern, for example, expressed relief that in contrast to Reagan, a much more reasonable man was in power in Moscow, and that was Yuri Andropov. McGovern said this, "I think we ought to be very thankful that this man Andropov seems to be a reasonable guy and somewhat restrained, because certainly the Reagan-Weinberger approach is one of those of intense confrontation. It's almost as though they were spoiling for a military showdown." That's the Democrat Party, the Democrat leader back in the 1960s and 70s. How about Jimmy Carter? Can anyone forget the fact that Jimmy Carter, as we have talked about on this program before, almost single-handedly delivered Iran to the mullahs, the Islamists. He delivered them. He cut the throat of the Shah, figuratively speaking. And the Shah's prime minister wrote a book about it. We talked about that at length on this program. But nevertheless, Jimmy Carter took Iran, which was our friend, which was our ally, and handed Iran to the Islamists. How about Senator Edward Kennedy? He was probably the most egregious. It was discovered by a researcher in 1991. Kennedy had actually communicated to Andropov, the Russian prime minister, to ask the Soviet dictator to help the Democrats challenge Reagan in 1984. Does anyone of the Democrats want to mention this? Have you heard about that in the mainstream media? They wanted them to Kennedy wanted them to interfere in the United States election. The memo expressed Kennedy's view that, as Kennedy put it, the only real potential threats to Reagan in his race, that is in 1984, are problems of war and peace and Soviet American relations. In every successive communist dictator, whether Brezhnev, Chernenko, Andropov, has been praised by the left, has always been praised by the left as superior to all of our conservatives, such as Reagan. As a matter of fact, it was even noted that Andropov, here's the mainstream media's coverage of Andropov. By the way, he was a dictator, put people in gulags. And here's how the mainstream media covered Andropov. They said, well, he likes classical music and occasional glasses of wine. And then, of course, they could not praise enough the people who followed him, Mikhail Gorbachev. It was so absurd, radio commentator Rush Limbaugh coined the term Gorbisms. At one time, Vladimir Putin was also on the left's good graces. Shortly after Obama took office in 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, presented him with a reset button. Does anybody remember that? Later, Obama declared that the reset button with Putin had worked. Yet when Trump now tries to take matters in his hands, and reset with the Russians, he is denounced by Brennan as a traitor. This all is so much over the top. It is so incredible, and it does show us that we are really at war right here in the United States. Now, I'm not saying that Putin is a saint, but he's also no Stalin either. But this is really not about Putin, is it? It's not about Russia at all. It's really about the left's desire to get rid of President Trump. And he is rattling their cages. He has taken the establishment and rattled it so hard, their teeth are still chattering. They don't even know what to do with him. He goes over to these different meetings, and he absolutely owns those meetings. When it comes, for example, to the G7 summit, or the meeting with the European Union, or NATO allies, boy, have you listened to his statements with NATO? He sat right across the table and told them, here's what's taking place. America is paying the lion's share of protection of the world, and you people are paying next to nothing. This is what the left hates. They want socialism. They want communism. That's exactly where socialism will take you. And they're doing everything they can. They're pulling out all stops to get rid of President Trump. But I'll tell you what, the American people are wising up to it. You have not seen so many people unhinged and off the rails in the mainstream media as we have lately. That's because they're not really about presenting the news. They're really not about reporting. They're about warping the minds and the opinions of people. You might as well sit in a collegiate classroom listening to a Marxist professor as to listen to the mainstream media. No, I predict President Trump is going to be successful, even in the next election. And this idea about Russia collusion is absolutely ludicrous. Even some of the Republicans have gotten on board with this. Have you noticed that? Even some Republicans have said, you know, this was not a wise thing, and he should not be talking with Vladimir Putin and so forth. Now, there's much more to be said on the subject, but that just shows you how far the mainstream media, in collusion with the Democrat Party and the deep state, have pushed, and many Republicans have buckled at their knees. Well, I'm proud of President Trump standing up and doing what exactly he ought to do. Done nothing wrong at all. He's done only that which is right regarding Putin. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. Did you hear of former President Obama's speech in South Africa this last week? I hope that you did, because it shows exactly where these socialist Marxists are headed and what their real intentions, what these are. One of the things that he said in that speech, which was honoring the 100th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's birth, is the following statement. He said, we're going to have to consider new ways of thinking about these problems, like a universal income, the review of our work week, and how we retrain our young people, and how we make everybody an entrepreneur at some level. But we're going to have to worry about economics if we want to get democracy back on track. Let's just stop here for a moment. Obama is touting what some socialists have already been so bold as to say in America, and that is we need to guarantee people an income, regardless of education, regardless of birth, regardless of work, regardless of effort. People need to be guaranteed a minimum income. This is socialism. This is exactly what he has always been. Now, it reminds me of what took place or is now taking place in the state of California, in one city particularly. And this is that a mayor wants to pay criminals not to murder. And that's exactly what Stockton, California Mayor Michael Tubbs has proposed. So if you're the mayor of a crime-ridden city, and you're closing facilities due to budget shortfalls because you don't have enough money, and everything's going into bankruptcy, your citizens are demanding an end to violence, what should you do? This is from the National Rifle Association magazine, brought this to my attention. Well, if you're in Stockton, California, Mayor Michael Tubbs, he says he's going to identify the 50 people most likely to commit crimes using a gun and offer to cut them a check. That's right. Now, the mayor's program is called Advance Peace. It offers 18 months of counseling, life coaching, job training, and daily check-ins to would-be shooters with a goal of cutting shootings in half over the next 4 years. Enrollees would also be offered a transformative travel consisting of a trip to a theme park along with a $1,000 per month stipend for enrollees who stay the course. The pilot city that began such a program is not even Stockton. It's Richmond, but it is also, as you might guess, in California. The program has fallen far short of expectations, as you might imagine. Despite the promise of cash payouts, a full 30% of participants have committed offenses again. Moreover, according to the Richmond Police Officers Association, the group has refused to work with law enforcement. In fact, one spokesperson said, they have worked hard to usurp the justice we work hard to serve our community. Well, here's the better idea. Remove the red tape restricting Californians' right to self-defense. Put criminals on notice that their next target could be their last. And by all means, start punishing instead of paying. What a ridiculous idea. This is why I say that liberalism eventually just pickles the mind. Paying people, that is people who are convicted of gun-related offenses, to not commit any longer. That is not going to work. But that's exactly what President Obama is proposing regarding work. He says, we're paying people, we're paying people not to work. A guaranteed minimum income means that we are paying people not to work. This is what's the problem in America. I've pointed out for a long time that the real issue is the welfare, unconstitutional, by the way, the welfare system. Our Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 only authorizes spending on approximately 20 different programs or 20 different areas, and these areas have nothing at all to do with redistributing funds from one pocket to the other. As a matter of fact, the crafters of the Constitution tell us plainly that the only spending that is constitutional, that is taxpayer money that is expended by the federal government, is that which can be enjoyed by all. That is only on public works, public things that everyone has advantage of. For example, road building or communication. All of these things have to do with that which we can all enjoy. But the idea of taking money from one pocket and putting it into another is absolutely unconstitutional. And more than that, it is immoral. And where does that stop? It, as you can see, it really doesn't stop. It only stops with the imagination of the lefties who continue to come up with the craziest nut ideas about paying people not to commit murder, or as Obama says, pay people not to work. Or he'll put it, a guaranteed minimum income. But what is that? That's to pay people not to work. If you pay people not to work, then they're not going to work. Here's an idea. Think about this. When you put money in any particular area, if you allocate money in a particular slot or any particular space or add it to a certain thing, that something will grow. You add money to it, it will grow. If you put money into people who are not working, that number will continue to grow. As an example, we've used on this program before, Medicare, or Medi-Cal, as it is called in California. In the 1960s it began. They had, at one point, 1967, 1 million people on the Medi-Cal roll. Paying people for medical procedures, those who were supposedly poor and could not afford it. And so taxpayer money, unconstitutionally, taken from the working Americans and given to those who were supposedly not able to pay for medical costs. What are you supposed to happen? Well, not only did medical costs begin at that point across the country, because that was Medicaid and Medicare, medical costs began to rise exponentially, primarily due to that intrusion right here. But not only that, but the roles of those who could not pay for the medical costs began to explode itself. For example, in California, within 1 year, the rolls went from 1 million to 2.5 million. Is anyone out there believing that 1.5 more million people in 1968 became poverty-stricken than was the case in 1967? No. We know what happened. Everybody who has common sense knows what happened. People saw that there was a free ticket, and they began to jump on that bandwagon. And it has become heavier and heavier. And instead of pulling back, rethinking the whole welfare system, which is unconstitutional and immoral, instead of rethinking it, the liberals simply want to add to it. So now, in California, they want to pay criminals, please don't murder, and we're going to pay you $1,000 a month if you stay in some of these programs. That is ludicrous on its face, just as is Obama's suggestion to pay people for not working or a guaranteed minimum income. Now, is this to say that we don't care for the poor or that we should not care for the poor? Absolutely not. But that is the province of individual contribution or congregational contribution, but it has nothing to do with government. It has nothing to do with government at all. Well, what is government? Government is merely the enforcers of the rules by which we live and manage our affairs in a society, and that's all that the government is to do. Here's an illustration. Walter Williams gave this one in one of his articles several years ago. He said, here's a group of men who are playing poker. And at that table, the poker table, after a certain amount of time passes, we recognize that perhaps on the other side of the table, Mike Kendron over here is making a lot of money. And some people on the other side of the table, such as Bill Lockwood, are making very little money, just not making anything at all. So what are we to do? Well, should we change the rules, tilt the tables to favor Bill Lockwood because Mike Kendron continues to take his money in this game? No, the rules and those who are to keep the rules, the proctor of the game, all their job is to make sure that the playing field or the table stays level. And that's their job. But no, now we come in society and say, no, look here, Lockwood's not making any money. We've got to tilt it in his direction. And we've got to take some from Mike forcibly and give it to Bill Lockwood. That's socialism. And that is wrong. It's immoral. And that goes a long way to explaining why our country is in the throes of immorality. Now, before I conclude this segment, I want to mention also this, something very important, and that is that the Bible teaches that if a man doesn't work, neither let him eat. It is God's law, not only in 2 Thessalonians 3 and 10, where in that passage is found, or 6, but it is also in the book of Proverbs and Psalms, the importance of being industrious and working. And that means sometimes withhold charity. That's important because sometimes we actually are encouraging non-work. One of the preachers from the 17th century, Scotton Mather, he made this statement, "Instead of exhorting you to augment your charity, I would rather utter an exhortation that you abuse not your charity by misapplying it. Let us do good with as much application of mind as wicked men employ in doing evil." In other words, we better be a little bit wiser in how we spend money and how we give away our money. And that should be, of course, the case for the government also. Mather's restraint and our exuberance indicates the difference between the dominant views of human nature then and now. Cotton Mather didn't assume that men and women naturally want to work. His view, and that most of the leaders of the country at that time recognized, and for the next two centuries recognized, that giving a choice between not working and working and receiving the same income, people are going to choose not working. Well, what is this going to bring about? It's going to bring about just hardcore communism if we go with former President Obama's suggestion. Everybody has a guaranteed minimum income. Unbiblical, immoral, and at the same time takes us right into communism. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. I wanted to talk for a few moments about democratic socialism. And that is really government-sanctioned theft by majority vote. Now, here's an article by Gary DeMar, one of the greatest writers on this particular topic. You can find his writings online. Gary DeMar points out that today's call for democratic socialism, of course, that's a rage. But advocates of democratic socialism give lip service only to capitalism or capitalist markets because they know the goose that really lays the golden egg. But here's how it works on a small scale, and it goes back to what I was saying the last segment or links into it. If someone breaks into your house to steal something, that person most likely will go to jail, or they should, or pay some type of restitution. What if a person who wants to steal from you calls on some of his neighbors to join him in stealing your identity? Would that be legal? What if when they were caught, they attempted to justify their actions by claiming that what they'd stolen was for a worthy cause? Some of them needed money to send their children to college. Others needed help with a mortgage payment. Would this neighborhood theft ring be morally justified if the cause was good? Absolutely not. We recognize theft is theft. It's not moral. It's not legal. It's sinful. But how about if this larger group decided to implement a political solution to avoid anti-theft legal sanctions by creating a government to pass laws to take money from some people so it can be given to other people? And you know what you call that? Democratic socialism. Theft by the majority. Using the power and force of government to extract money from some people to give it, to be given to others, is in essence democratic socialism. I want to talk for just a moment about the word democracy. I hear, and you will hear, democracy kicked around so frequently as if we live in a democracy. That is absolutely not true. Democracy is not a good thing. There are certain expressions of democracy that aren't good. One of the last accurate definitions of democracy was published in 1928 in a training manual developed by the U.S. War Department. And it was described as a government of the masses. Authority was said to be, quote, derived through mass meeting or any other form of direct expression. Direct democracy, according to the manual, would result in, get this, mobocracy. That's exactly right. Direct democracy, that is where everybody's involved, where the majority rule, that's masses of people rule, that leads right into mobocracy. The attitude toward property is communistic, that is negating property rights. This is from the U.S. War Department's training manual and their definition of democracy. The attitude toward property is communistic, negating property rights. Attitude toward law is that the will of the majority shall regulate, whether it is based upon deliberation or governed passion, prejudice, impulse, without restraint or regard to consequences. End of quote. In a word, direct democracy makes we the people the immediate sovereigns without any guarantee of external moral restraint. See Greg Singer, echoing this definition, writes this statement regarding democracy. Modern political theory has replaced the doctrine of the sovereignty of God with that of the sovereignty of man and manifests itself either in anarchy or totalitarianism. Now get that. Democracy is going to go one direction or the other, and usually it goes to anarchy and then to totalitarianism. He says either anarchy or totalitarianism. Democracy then has become a political god. Vox populi, vox dei. For many, the voice of the people is the voice of God. Is it any wonder that John Adams, the second president of the United States, said that the voice of the people sometimes is the voice of Muhammad or of Caesar, the Pope, or the devil? Adams also wrote, if the majority is 51 and the minority 49, is it certainly the voice of God? If tomorrow one should change to 50 versus 50, where's the voice of God? If two and the minority should become the majority, has the voice of God changed? So asked John Adams. Back to this other preacher, John Cotton. I talked about a preacher from the 16th century a moment ago, 17th century. This is one from the 16th century. Puritan minister in Massachusetts wrote, 1636, democracy I do not conceive that ever God did ordain as a fit government, either for church or commonwealth. If the people be governors, who shall be governed? Federalist Papers, number 10, James Madison, fourth president of the United States, the father of the Constitution, said, democracies are the spectacles of turbulence and contention. Pure democracies are incompatible with personal security or the rights of property. In general, they have been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. How do you like that? Here is James Madison. We had John Adams. Now, do these men oppose the democratic process? Well, rulers were chosen by the general vote of the people through the raising of hands. Madison cannot be accused of rebuffing democratic process since the Constitution mandates that representatives be elected by popular vote. Maybe it's because they understood the observational wisdom of this quotation, and this is usually attributed to Alexander Tyler. Though not substantiated, the sentiments are about money. And here's what Tyler wrote. A democracy cannot exist as a pure form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover, and you'll find this is exactly what's happening in America. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse, that's benefits for themselves, from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by dictatorship. The Christian philosopher and apologist Francis Schaeffer described democracy as the dictatorship of 51% with no controls, nothing with which to challenge the majority. Many who are arguing against homosexual marriage are doing so by an appeal to poll numbers. What's wrong with that? Doesn't matter what poll numbers say. That's what's the matter with it. I don't care what poll numbers say. What we're interested in is, number one, what does the law of God say, and what does natural law teach? Now, that appeal might work over a short run, but over the long run, it doesn't work because opinion polls change and public opinion shifts rapidly. So our founders did not want a pure democracy by the majority. Even if they're Christians, they didn't want them being the majority and that being a democracy. John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, said, direct democracy is the meanest and worst of all forms of government. Isn't it amazing that so many people today think that we're in a democracy where the majority rules? And this is exactly what our founders had to say, however, on it. The truth is, we are a republic. And the difference is that a republic is a government that is guided by those who are elected. We elect individuals to do our thinking for us, or at least not our thinking, but at least our voting in state houses, in local houses of government, and in the national legislature. We have a representative government, and that is the difference between a democracy and a republic. And our troubles today, in large measure, are coming about because a century ago, a decided change was made in the period of Woodrow Wilson to quit calling us a republic and start calling us a democracy. And even conservative commentators use the word democracy all the time talking about America. That is not what we were designed to be, and it will not lead us to any good in the end. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. I do want to take a few moments, and the last of the program here, to talk a little bit more about socialism. And that's exactly where many people, of course, on the left are. That's where they're trying to drag the rest of the Americas and that American people and the states into a socialist type of a union under some kind of a dictatorship, a strong-armed government. I have in front of me, by the way, before I look at this, I might want to back up for a moment. I've seen some people say some things recently such as, well, you know, socialism sometimes works in countries here and there, and it works in this. You know, number one, I deny that it works. Socialism has never worked. It's always an abysmal failure. People say, well, everybody has health care in this socialist country. Do you know the lines, the long lines that forge outside of healthcare clinics in those countries? When everybody has free health care, they wait and wait and wait, because that's the nature of socialism. But let's say that that is wrong. Let's say that socialism works fine as far as delivering health care. That doesn't make it right. It's immoral as a system. It's ungodly and it's immoral. And yet we have people in our country who are avowed socialists who are running for office in different places. One of them is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. Margaret Hoover asked this socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez questions during firing line last Friday. And this is the candidate who won, the 10-term Democrat, over 10-term Democrat, Joe Crowley, in the primaries in June. And she stumbled and dithered, and she admitted she really didn't know what she was talking about. She characterized the generations-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict as occupation of Palestine by Israel. Isn't that just what you might expect a socialist to say? She said the following, I think that what people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is an increasing crisis of humanitarian conditions. And that, to me, is just where I tend to come on in this issue. Now, Hoover pressed, that is the interviewer, the young socialist to explain exactly what she meant. And so Ocasio-Cortez, after a long pause, said, oh, I think, well, what I mean is that the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to the housing and homes. Now, recognizing the incoherency of that response, interviewer Hoover pushed further, asking her to explain exactly what do you mean? Ocasio-Cortez admitted, well, I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue, but she's going to go ahead and forge ahead anyway into this unknown territory. And here's what she went on to say. I am a firm believer in finding a two-state solution on this issue, and I'm happy to sit down with leaders on both of these. For me, I just look at things through a human rights lens, and I may not use the right words, but I know this is a very intense issue. So Hoover then changed the subject to capitalism, asking the young socialist, do you think that capitalism has failed to deliver for working class Americans? And then Hoover cited the booming economy and record low unemployment, all of course, which came under Trump. And Ocasio-Cortez said, well, unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs. I thought, oh, brother. Capitalism has not always existed in the world and will not always exist in the world. Now, what does that mean? Where in the world is she coming on this? Hoover then asked if she thought capitalism would survive, and the candidate for the House of Representatives in the 14th District of New York just shrugged, saying, that's a good question, and the system will evolve. She's running for office, challenging Joe Crowley, who's the fourth-ranking Democrat in the House and slated to take over from Nancy Pelosi as Speaker in the House if Democrats regain control in November. And she had pat answers to the world problems. Medicare for everyone, federal jobs guarantee, tuition-free public education, abolition of ICE, more gun controls, and ending the privatization of prisons. Sounds like the old Soviet Union, doesn't it? Let's just pick up one of these here for just a moment, and that is the federal jobs guarantee, or as former President Obama said the other day in South Africa, that is a guaranteed minimum income. Now, what's the problem with this federal jobs guarantee? Just look at our school system. Why is it? Are we putting more people through high school? Yes, the answer is yes. In America, we have put more people through high school. They have more diplomas than ever before. That is the case. And it's not simply because there are more people than ever before. We're graduating more a percentage of the people that have come into high school. Is that the bottom line? No, it is not the bottom line. What is the bottom line? The educational level has dropped significantly. dramatically, and America is something like 18th on the in the international scale. Whereas we have been higher, much higher in the past, we have dramatically dropped. Yes, we're handing certificates to kids, but they don't know anything. Many of them don't. And that's exactly what is going to take place here. This is exactly how socialism works. We have a socialistic program in the public school system. And it is not giving better education. It is giving more certificates to people. And there is a difference. So when we come to this, and Ocasio-Cortez says, well, everyone is going to have a job. Federal jobs guarantee. Everybody will have a job. But what is going to happen to the quality of work in America? It's going to plummet because there's only one incentive that God has built into the system, and that is your own needs. You have needs of food, housing, companionship, clothing, so forth. Those are needs. You have wants and needs, and these needs are to be met by your laboring in order to earn them. This is the system that God set up. And as long as we continue on this humanistic socialism, which is grounded in an atheistic worldview, then we are going to abysmally fail. Whether we guarantee everybody a job or everybody a grade on a paper or everybody a graduation certificate, we will miserably fail. The quality of America, American work, American people, the American production is going to plummet absolutely, as it already has in so many areas, just as has happened in education. So when they talk about this, keep that in mind. Now, in this particular interview, when seeking support, Ocasio-Cortez looked to her membership in a particular society that she has belonged to, and she belonged to the Democratic Socialist of America, DSA. That was the group that propelled her to victory in the primary with the help of, by the way, Black Lives Matter, which is a socialistic group. The brand new Congress, that's the name of it, and the Justice Democrats, among others. And that these are all organizations that are wanting us to socialize in the United States and give us a European-style socialist nirvana. The mission is anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, democrat socialist, eco-socialist, multi-tendency, and socialist feminization. The same group that has in the past supported Walter Mondale, Jesse Jackson, John Kerry, Barack Obama, and Bernie Sanders. And that is exactly what New York and apparently many people in California are going toward. This, of course, is a formula for failure. And America will not do better. We will not improve unless we get rid of this mentality and get rid of that worldview and go with what we have in the White House now, President Donald Trump, who's rolling back regulations. By the way, this is interesting to me, just while mentioning it. There are a lot of people who say, well, President Trump is moving towards the Nazism. We're going to talk about that, by the way, in a future program coming up. Nazism, President Trump, and so forth. They say, well, he's moving toward Nazism. Nazism, ladies and gentlemen, is National Socialism. That's what it is. And he has done the very opposite of that. He's rolled back regulations, rolled back the state. That is the opposite of socialism. That's the opposite of Nazism. And unless we can get on board with that and support our president, America is doomed. I also want to make mention of the fact that I myself have a book out. It is called Ezekiel, the Watchman of Israel, a study guide regarding the Old Testament prophetic book of Ezekiel. And you can buy it on Amazon.com. It is a study guide that helps you step through the book of Ezekiel and examine some of those very critical issues, as well as some of controversial issues, such as Gog and Magog and Ezekiel 38 and 39. So Amazon.com is where you can buy that book. So go to our website. You can find everything here at American Liberty with BillLockwood.com. We thank you today for listening.